tonight on Arena. Keanu Reeves in Waiting for Godot on Broadway, Mary Lavin and her work on The New Yorker, and Series 2 of the RTE drama Obituary. And you're very welcome along to tonight's Arena 51551. If you'd like to text us, arena@rte.ie is always the email. We are on Instagram at RTE_arena. Born to Irish parents in Massachusetts in 1912, Mary Lavin was without doubt one of our great short story writers. She was considered the equal of her good friend Frank O'Connor, and other peers and admirers included Eudora Welty, Elizabeth Bowen and John McGarren. In 1957, J.D. Salinger recommended her to the New Yorker magazine, and over the next three decades, she published 16 stories with them, including some of her most famous, like In the Middle of the Fields. When she died in 1996, Lavin left behind some 400 letters to Rachel McKenzie, her editor at The New Yorker. They're letters full of detail that include everything from adventurous road trips with her kids to casual mentions of David Bowie. Gráinne Hurley explores these letters in her new book, Gratefully and Affectionately, Mary Lavin and The New Yorker. And I'm delighted that Gráinne joins me now in studio, along with Kathleen McMahon, writer and granddaughter of Mary Lavin. Gráinne, how did you come to hear about these letters initially?
Well, how I heard about them was I was actually researching for my PhD, and I was originally going to write about Maeve Brennan and The New Yorker. And at the same time, around that time, Mary Lavin's family had donated Mary Lavin's papers to UCD. So I knew she worked, or she wrote for The New Yorker as well. So I had a look and I came across a letter from J.D. Salinger, and in it he urged her to write for The New Yorker because he found them very good to work for, write for, and because it paid handsomely. So that, I was fascinated by that.
Was that the moment where your eyes started to sparkle when you saw
yeah,
that one?
Exactly. So then I went to the New York Public Library to research the New Yorker records and Mary Lavin's papers and anything on Maeve Brennan as well. And it was there that I found a letter that J.D. Salinger wrote to his New Yorker editor, William Maxwell, on the same day that he wrote to Mary Lavin, recommending her as a contributor. And it's like piecing, you know, the two pieces together of a jigsaw. And then I discovered the letters that between herself and Rachel McKenzie, her New Yorker editor. And as you say, there were almost 400 letters between them.
It sounds like a complicated process. There's an, as I presume in a lot of books like this, an awful lot of detective work that goes on.
There was, but I loved that side of it. Yeah, I really enjoyed that side. And you're kind of going down a rabbit hole because you keep finding more information and more letters. You know, that was part of, a hard part of the book was actually finishing it and not looking for more information.
Kathleen, the book takes us back to a time when letters were the main form of communication, and even the editing of short stories was done. Sheafs of pages were being sent off in the post between Ireland and America. There's Mary Lavin on her farm in County Meath, and she's writing to Eudora Welty, and she's writing to J.D. Salinger. It's a different time.
That's what I find amazing about it. I mean, I find that quite moving to think of her. She's a widow. She's in this house in the middle of the fields, literally in County Meath. She was an established writer by then, but she was a widow with three kids who she was trying to provide for them. And just to think that this network develops by virtue of the quality of her writing is what's so moving to me. So, as you say, you have her writing to Eudora Welty in Mississippi, and then these letters from J.D. Salinger in Vermont, and connecting her to the centre of the universe in literary terms, which was the New Yorker magazine, and all by post. And then the editing process has to take place really slowly, with stories being sent back and forth across the Atlantic. And even the cost of the postage was significant for her. I know sometimes she'd be looking for somebody to carry an edit with them to New York.
I've seen that in the book, that it is something that the budget wasn't always necessarily there just for it simply to be put in the post.
Exactly. So sometimes it would go surface mail if there were lengthier manuscripts. And if it was urgent, it would go airmail. But there were also telegrams and cables between them as well for more urgent matters. But it's fascinating. And the postal system was very good because they tended to respond to each other almost immediately. And only on one occasion, a story one summer got lost in the post. So it's pretty incredible over the almost 30 years she was working with The New Yorker.
And knowing the chaotic nature, I mean, she was quite chaotic in her personal affairs. And I just shudder to think how all this came to be when you think of how disordered sometimes her affairs were. And, you know, things would be thrown into a suitcase if she was going travelling along with bills and all sorts of things. Then she'd try to work on the train or work on the mail boat. So it's kind of miraculous that
yes.
they managed to complete these laborious edits.
Her becoming involved in The New Yorker at that time is an interesting one, because it was a point, strangely, at which The New Yorker were looking for writers, because writers of the type of fiction that they were looking for were elsewhere.
I know. I mean, I'm hesitant to say this because any writers who are listening will weep to know that The New Yorker were hungry to find writers of fiction at that time. People like Nabokov, who would have been writing for them, had been attracted to other places like Hollywood that were more lucrative. So a lot of the kind of stable of writers they had before then, is that right, Grania?
That's right, yeah. So there was a short supply of fiction in 1957. So the likes, say, of Nabokov and John O'Hara, Sally Benson started writing for theatre and for Hollywood, as you say, and musicals and so on. So it was more lucrative than writing for The New Yorker. But that opened the way for writers like Mary Lavin, Muriel Spark, Philip Roth, you know, to come into the magazine as well.
She's an established writer at this point, but presumably yeah. when you start to become a New Yorker writer, that then in and of itself moves your writing career to a different level.
Absolutely. It definitely moved her to a larger international platform. And as I said earlier, that she was paid very well in writing for The New Yorker. So, for example, her first published story in The New Yorker was The Living, and she was paid $935 for that story. And that enabled her to buy her muse on Lad Lane. Now, granted, it was a bit of a stable, but she said it was a shambles of a stable that she hoped would go cheap, and it did, and she bought it. But it's now for sale for almost 1.4 million.
For those people who aren't familiar with that part of Dublin, too.
To do it up. I mean, my mother remembered the cheques coming from The New Yorker, and it would be, you know, happy times are here, and we're all going buying shoes. And
that's right. But Caroline had said, told me that when a New Yorker cheque arrived, she'd bring them to the Shelburne for tea, and they'd get new clothes, or they'd stay in Buswell's Hotel. So, when the money came in, she was delighted with it. But
at one stage, I think there were cats, an infestation of rats in the mews, and she left the cats to deal with the rats, and she moved everybody into Buswell's.
Because we probably shouldn't underestimate how much that meant to a writer at that point, particularly a writer who wasn't well off. Frequently, The New Yorker made sure that they took care of their contributors to the point where it did allow them to live a comfortable life.
It did. So it paid advances as well to its writers. Plus, Mary Lavin had the highly coveted first reading agreement, which gave the magazine first refusal. But that contract kind of bound the writer to the magazine in a way. So she was paid an annual fee for that, usually $100, but that could fluctuate according to her sales. So, but also having that contract meant that she got an extra 25% on each story that she sold. And if she sold a number of stories within the quantity bonus period, a set number of stories, she'd get another 25%. So it was very lucrative when she was doing well with the magazine and was purchasing her stories.
But they did reject a lot of her stories, which is important to say as well, just in case it sounds like it was all easy and Salinger recommends her. And I mean, I don't know how many in total, but there's a lot of rejections. The first five were rejected.
That's right. Yes.
That she sent them.
And in a cafe, when the magazine first made contact with her, she hadn't been writing for many years after her husband's death. And it really lit a spark, a creative spark in her. And she wrote 10,000 words in 10 days. The two stories that she wrote were In a Cafe and Lemonade. But they actually rejected In a Cafe. Initially, they did eventually publish it because it featured a writer and they preferred not to publish stories that featured writers. So she revised the story and she removed the reference to the main character being a writer and published it. But that's another side to Mary Lavin. She was very practical. She wasn't precious about her story. She didn't see The New Yorker version being the final definitive version of her work. She knew she could revise it for future publication and reinstate, restore any elements that she didn't like, that they changed. But she actually did keep the removal of the author in a cafe.
I think she's one half of this story as well. We should be conscious, because Gratefully and Affectionately isn't just about Mary Lavin. It's about Rachel McKenzie, who's her longtime editor at The New Yorker. She was an interesting and an important figure in the history of the magazine as well. She discovered and handled some of their most important writers, Philip Roth, Muriel Spark. Tell me about her.
Rachel McKenzie is very much overlooked in the annals of The New Yorker. And it's understandable, because as an editor, you know, the reader doesn't realise that the editor behind it. But she was instrumental in securing Mary Lavin's success in the magazine, because they formed a very close working relationship and personal relationship. Mary Lavin first met her in person in 1963 when she went over to New York, and they formed a very close bond. And then the letters changed. They became more intimate. They started sharing their health woes, financial difficulties and so on. Also, you know, their living arrangements when they were moving around the place. And it was very important. And Rachel McKenzie had suffered from ill health over the years. And in 1970, she underwent heart surgery, which was a relatively new procedure at the time. And after that, she just took a step back from working. She was working part time. But to jump forward, when she basically retired from the magazine, you could see the decline, both in the correspondence with The New Yorker, and also Mary Lavin only had one more story published after she left.
I found it amazing the extent of that personal relationship. I wonder, is that something that's changed now? I think relationships between editors and publishers and writers tend to be more professional now, probably, and have less of the personal in them. I mean, they're pouring their hearts out to each other a lot of the time. And some of that makes this book a really interesting read, because it's such an insight into kind of the difficulties of being a writer. You know, she talks about how much she feels that the writing is taking her away from the children and the garden, and how hard it is for a woman to devote her time to writing. And all of that is really interesting. And it's really her pouring out her heart to Rachel McKenzie and sharing her troubles with her.
We had one of the current New Yorker editors, Cressida Leishen, was on Arena with us last week. It's not a conversation. It's a conversation I thought to have with her at the time. But you're probably entirely right, Grainne. Do you think that Rachel McKenzie was overlooked in comparison to her male counterparts at the time?
I do, absolutely. And she formed a very close bond with her writers, which wasn't unusual. You know, William Maxwell had a very close friendship with Frank O'Connor, Eudora Welty and John Cheever, for example. But she had some writers who didn't like her, let's say, over intimate approach. They felt like Muriel Spark, for example, thought she was a clinger and a control freak, and she demanded another editor in the magazine. And Muriel Spark and Shirley Hazard and herself dreaded her claustrophobic Sunday suppers. But it was an approach that worked for Mary Lavin, because I think they both had this nurturing approach to writing. And she liked the feedback. She needed that feedback, because her approach was, her writing was very much a work in progress. She'd send off a draft and wait for McKenzie's feedback, rather than give her a polished final version, because that enabled her to move on to a new story. And then if she got that back and they didn't want it, she could tweak it.
You talk about it in the book, though, that she found it very hard sometimes to move on to a new story if the story hadn't been either accepted or rejected, and she was just waiting for that feedback to come, that she almost found herself in a writer's block situation.
Exactly. And that was quite sad, because, you know, she was waiting for that feedback, but also she kept trying to revise stories so that they would suit The New Yorker. She tried her best, but you can see why she did, because she made more money if she sold a story to them, and then if she sold so many within a certain period and so on. But she also knew that she'd get rejected stories published elsewhere, and that she could put them into collections.
Kathleen, there's plenty in these letters to interest writers and to interest editors and people who just love Mary Lavin's writing. What for you stands out about what's in this book? What did you learn, if anything?
Well, we learned loads of kind of colour about her life. And that, like, it's a wonderful thing if somebody like Grainne goes to the trouble of reading all these letters in her terrible handwriting and fishing out all these delicious details. I mean, we knew from stories handed down that she used to take my mother and her sisters on these madcap drives across Europe, maybe after a cheque from The New Yorker had come in, or she did also get Guggenheim money at various points during the 50s and 60s. But she would take them off in her sports car.
Mars Minor convertible.
Yes, and the Ford, was it a Ford coupe?
And there's a Triumph later on.
Triumph Herald coupe. with a tricolour flying from the front of it. And at one stage, they drove all the way to Istanbul, sleeping in the car sometimes. So we never knew about that. We never knew about David Bowie. I mean, that was
You have to tell us the David Bowie story, because there's an awful lot of people won't know this particular element of David Bowie's history.
Well, Gronje uncovered this. Apparently, my grandmother had a fear of flying. After her husband died, she never flew again. So she used to take these long boat passages to New York and back. And apparently David Bowie also had a fear of flying. Is that right?
I don't know.
Somebody told me that. So that would explain why he was on the boat.
Yes, yeah.
But we never knew that. You uncovered that David Bowie had been on the boat with her in 1974, was it?
Is that something like that? Yeah, 1974.
I think it reflects very badly on David Bowie that she never mentioned him. He mustn't have made a great impression.
Did he not give a performance on the boat? I could have sworn I
he did. He gave an impromptu performance on the boat.
But obviously didn't leave an enormous impression.
It didn't make much of an impression on Mary.
Gráinne, much of the correspondence between Mary and Rachel, and it has to understandably do with the revising and the redrafting, she comes across in these letters as not being precious at all about the work, or was she?
She was. I mean, there were certain changes that she did resist if she felt strongly, and then the magazine didn't push on that. But they had their own house rules as well. And, you know, William Shawn was quite precious about, you know, he did a great sense of delicacy about what was published in the magazine. So, for example, in Trastevere, she had a baby, you know, with the udder leaking on the ground, and that had to be excised from the story. But again, as I say, she wasn't precious in that she was amenable to changes, knowing that it was still her story and she could revise it again for future publications. But if there was something that she felt strongly about, she would put her foot down. If it didn't ring true to the story, she'd put her foot down. And, you know, her stories tended to be quite long. So Rachel McKenzie's job was, you know, having to reduce the length of the stories.
And Kathleen, her handwriting was an issue. I know we've touched on this, but it's also mentioned in the book that sometimes she found herself writing so fast and so quickly that she could look back on her own handwriting and not necessarily realise what she'd written.
I think so. You can see that in some of the manuscripts, can't you, Gráinne, that are in the UCD special collections. She used to doodle on things as well. So there is this kind of creative energy of her. And also, even after books had been published, she used to go back to the printed book and edit in the margins. So she never gave up on a story. I don't think she ever finished them. She was always improving them. It's kind of torture to go back over something that's been maybe gone through the New Yorker into a published collection of stories and you're still writing in the margins.
That you never abandon it, as it were.
Yeah. But her approach was she thought she was improving on the story for the reader, and that's why she revised the stories. And just on the handwriting as well, she had told Ivan Boland in an interview that it was one of her big regrets in life that she never learned to type. So sometimes, you know, and it was a painstaking process to just try and decipher her handwriting. And it was an issue for Rachel McKenzie as well when it came to editing her work. She'd guess at some of the words.
Do you think part of the rewriting process was that some of her stories were semi-autobiographical and that she felt that perhaps there were elements in those stories that she felt either more or less comfortable over the course of time sharing?
I think she very much made her stories with her hands. There's a lot of insight into that kind of craft process. At one stage, she says that she felt like she crocheted them or made them with a crochet hook. So, yeah, I think, and that's back again to the whole thing about her relationship with Mackenzie as well. I think she didn't really separate her life from her work. It was all one big mix. And people coming in and out of the house, the children, the work, the papers on the desk, the cooking, the gardening. It was all a big kind of mess that she was trying to sort out and yet use the discipline of writing to put shape on it.
Exactly. And her writing revolved around her children and the holidays. You know, so she'd have a break when they'd be back at school, and then summertime she'd head off on her Guggenheim or New Yorker money and bring them all over Europe. But yes, that puts some sort of a, as you say, discipline
on it. But the rigour of the craft, and that's the amazing thing, that she did produce these incredibly beautifully crafted stories out of that chaotic mixture of ingredients that she had.
Gráinne, Rachel McKenzie died in 1980, by which time Mary's contributions to the New Yorker had pretty much ceased at that stage. Do you think she'd fallen out of fashion, or do you think that that pretty much solely lies at what we were talking about earlier, which is the importance of Rachel McKenzie's role in publishing her in the first place?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. Certainly when Rachel McKenzie left, she had a few different writers who editors who looked after her work. Derek Morgan was one, and Charles Chip McGrath was another. And but definitely Rachel McKenzie invested not a lot of work in Lavin, and she tried her best to get to make her stories fit the magazine's requirements. And I just don't know if later editors put that time into Lavin, but also they were publishing a different type of story at that stage as well, because her contract wasn't renewed in 1987. So a lot of changes were afoot. Advanced Publications took over The New Yorker and initially promised that nothing would change. But William Shawn, the chief editor, was really forced to retire in 1987. And that year, Lavin's contract wasn't renewed. So they were culling a lot of the writers who were on contract, and she hadn't been productive for about 11 years. They hadn't published any of her stories. So she was quite a target, really, for...
The amazing thing is to watch the rise and fall of a writer's career even after their death, in that, yes, definitely there was that period where she wasn't being published by The New Yorker and she was getting old. You know, she's not out there promoting her work. And then after she died. But then we've seen in the last maybe 10 or 15 years an amazing rise again in her career, partly through the work of people like Sinead Gleeson, who've been anthologising women short story writers. And now there's a new collection, newly selected stories coming out in the US and the UK next year, which is really exciting. So it's amazing that almost organic forces pull
Mary Lavin Place.
And Mary Lavin Place, yeah.
It's been genuinely fascinating talking to both of you about the book. Gráinne Hurley and Kathleen McMahon, thank you so much. The book is called Gratefully and Affectionately, Mary Lavin and the New Yorker. It's published by New Ireland, and Gráinne and Kathleen will be appearing at the Leaves Festival of Writing and Music in Laois. That's on the 7th of October with Alice Ryan. And if you'd like to go, there are more details at leavesfestival.ie. When news broke that Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter were taking on Waiting for Godot, it sounded like an elaborate internet hoax. You don't hear announcements for Bill and Ted Do Beckett every week. But in a production by Jamie Lloyd, one of theatre's most prominent and inventive directors, the unlikely casting has turned into one of Broadway's most talked about productions this year.
Who am I to tell my private nightmares to if I can't tell them to you?
Let them remain private. You know I can't bear that.
There are times when I wonder if it wouldn't be better for us to part.
You wouldn't go far.
Emer McBride went along to see whether the experiment worked, and she joins me now to tell me more. Emer, what was your first thought when you heard that this production was happening?
I mean, to be honest, I just thought it was a joke. I know Jamie Lloyd is famous for his very starry casting, but... you know, the first thing I thought was, oh, Vladimir and Estragon's Bogus Journey. What a great idea.
What was your thought then when you made it to the production and when you came in? Tell us a little bit about the experience of what that was like.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, Beckett was very particular in his list of instructions for how the stage should look. A country road, a tree, that's it. And, you know, we all know the Beckett estate is very finickety about those rules being followed. But actually, when the curtain came up, there was a giant funnel in the centre of the stage, a bit like a storm drain. And most of the action happened at the front of that. So I kept sort of looking, thinking, can I just not see the country road and the tree from this stage?
Are they hidden in darkness?
Yes, I had a good investigate, and there was no country road or tree.
Jamie Lloyd's an interesting one, isn't he? Before we actually get into to the performances and the actors involved, he's known for very distinctive, very, very star-driven productions. How does he handle this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think this one works very well. I mean, obviously the Sigourney Weaver one and the Nicole Scherzinger ones were very successful, and the Tom Holland one and Romeo and Juliet a bit less so. But actually, the more I thought about this casting, the more genius it actually seemed to me. Of course, they have, you know, a natural sort of clowning ability, although you don't see it in Keanu Reeves in his sort of John Wick and Matrix incarnations. But, you know, going back to those, the Bill and Ted movies, of course, that kind of haplessness is there, and they do bring that. And they also bring their own, you know, they've worked together a lot over the years, not only on those films, but on other things as well. And you can really feel the kind of the bond between them, and it really warms the production up. So I thought it was actually fantastic casting.
And in terms of him as a director, where does he have them on stage? What's it like in terms of how that plays out?
Well, you know, I think obviously it's a tricky one because they're not stage actors. And, you know, Broadway, those old theatres are big theatres, and that's a lot of space for someone to fill. I mean, it's quite interesting in their biographies, in the programme, they're very keen to sort of pad out, you know, Keanu having played Hamlet at the Manitoba Theatre Centre in the 90s and Alex Winter having been on stage with Yul Brynner and You and I as a, or The King and I as a child. But, you know, that doesn't really help them on the night. And so Jamie Lloyd kind of pushes them to the front of this huge storm drain, and they spend a lot of the production sitting right up on the lip of the stage or getting up and pacing up and down the storm drain. But they're kept very close and very much in camera, actually. So there's no kind of anxious wandering around or, you know, things that you might get from someone who's not used to having so much space to fill.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about their performances in just a second, but I do have a clip here. This is of Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter talking about their roles in the production, and they're talking to Stephen Colbert.
It talks about our relationship to a personal God. And it's like, can we be seen? Will we be judged? But really, you know, will he save us, punish us? Will we be seen in a broad sense? And then there is friendship, codependence, yearning, waiting.
Yeah.
What are we waiting for? What can we do? How do we relate to each other? There's elements of power dynamics with a character, Pazzo and Lucky.
Yeah, there's brutality. There's the characters can become both brutal and loving. Like, you end up playing all of life in the course of 2 hours, which is... it's kind of a trip, to be honest with you, because it's so beautifully written.
Yeah, and about time, the collapsing of time, the human experience in the blink of an eye. I was born, and one day I can be born, one day I will die, one day I will be deaf, one day the circumstances of our life and how we relate to it.
We did talk about the fact that we were both doing it in our, we were both going to turn 60 around the time we hit the stage, and it is a play about reflection, about life and mortality and where you are and what does it mean and what have you done and where are you going. And to be in that every night and to say those words, but to do that with a very close friend is pretty extraordinary.
Okay, Emer, let's get into the business end of this. How were Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter as Vladimir and Estragon?
You know what? They were great. I went in with the lowest of expectations and, you know, probably a bit mean-spirited. But actually, I really thought they did a great job. And, you know, Alex Winter as Vladimir has the kind of the heftier role in that he has to kind of sort through what's going on and deal with Estragon much more. Keanu Reeves' performance is very physical, and he's wonderful at physical comedy. He kind of climbs up the sides of the funnel, and then his whole body sort of collapses like he's made out of rubber, and he sort of slides back down. And this is kind of a recurring kind of gag that goes on. And Alex Winter handles the kind of the difficulty of trying to hold it together really beautifully, actually, really poignantly. And then, of course, when Pazzo and Lucky arrive, the whole dynamic changes again and it becomes much more heightened.
And what about the Pazzo and Lucky that we get in this production?
I have to say, I think Brandon J. Durden as Pazzo is probably the best Pazzo I've ever seen. He was absolutely magnetic. He just held the stage, which, you know, is no easy task if you've got movie stars standing around you. But he was really, you know, sort of terrifying, and that character is such a monster. And he just embraced it with sort of swagger and horror. And, you know, there was, you know, with Jamie Lloyd, you kind of wonder, is there an element of trying to play a sort of Lawrence Fishburne element? You know, you've got this very tall actor and he's wearing his long leather coat and he's got his dark glasses on the whole way through. But, Brandon Dearden, just he blew it all away. You just had no doubt that this was an actor really at the height of his powers. It was probably the best one I've seen. And then Michael Patrick Thornton as Lucky is, you know, again, it's a very hard part because most of the time he's just there being ordered around and being brutalized. And in this, you know, he's brought on in a wheelchair and he has a kind of Victorian leather restraint mask on for most of the time until they, you know, they take it off and they make him think. And suddenly this sort of weird, endless sentence just comes pouring out. And I think it's probably the first time I've heard that the Lucky Think monologue and really understood why they freak out and are terrified at the end. You know, he brought a real kind of horror to it and a kind of a hopelessness but also, you know, kind of drew out this sort of environmental terror that's in the text as well. And yeah, I thought it was actually extraordinary and they, you know, they really held the production together.
It's a slight sidebar of a question, but what were the audience like? And I ask that because sometimes when you have these productions that have very starry casts in them, people, I'm sure, were going in with the expectation of seeing Bill and Ted do Beckett.
Yeah, they did. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of excitement. Oh, my God, it's going to be Bill and Ted on the stage. And, you know, and to be fair, they did, Keanu and Alex did play up to it. And we got a couple of gags about, oh, it's great to be back here again, like in the 90s. And there was, in fact, a moment where they both sort of went back to back and played air guitar. And of course, the audience erupted in hysterics. And I just thought, oh, God, this is so cheesy, but also laughed like an idiot because it was so kind of wonderful and, you know, sort of perfect for the moment. So, you know, they and then they settled back down into the tragedy and the alienation and the loss. And but yeah, it was they handled it very well, I think.
And where does the balance fall in this in terms of that in the production? Because sometimes Waiting for Godot can feel slow. It can feel overly philosophical. It doesn't sound like that sort of production in the most. How do they handle that balance?
No, I think they really slipped out of that old trap of this kind of hefty, ponderous, you know, slightly boring, very worthy Godot. And they kind of zipped through it. I mean, occasionally they maybe could have slowed down just a little and given the text a bit more space. But I think by and large, they really brought the audience along with them. And by the end, you know, it was incredibly poignant and you had this sort of terrible, you could feel Vladimir's sort of terrible despair and his frustration with Estragon, who just cannot remember why they're there, what's supposed to happen, what they're going to be doing next. And, you know, there was a real quality of someone who's losing a friend to dementia. And I've not seen that brought out in a Godot before, and I thought there was something actually very beautiful about it. So, for all of the fun and games, I think they really got to the heart of the play.
You sound like, for somebody who went in with very low expectations, you really enjoyed it.
Oh yeah, I'm a convert. If it wasn't over in New York, I'd be going to see it again, I think.
And do you think these two young lads who are the leads have any future on the stage?
I think youth is perhaps flown, but I don't know. I think maybe a very targeted production, I'd say they could be lured back in, and I would definitely go.
It's been fantastic talking to you tonight. Thank you so much, Emer McBride.
Thank you.
Waiting for Godot runs until the end of the year at the Hudson Theatre on Broadway. Now, odds are most of us won't be able to make it. And so instead, just to finish, here are Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter in less serious times.
Dudes, you guys are going to go back in time.
Yeah!
You are going to have the most excellent adventure through history. Who are you guys?
We're you, dude!
No way. No way.
Yes way, Ted!
Look, we know how you feel. We didn't believe it either when we were you, and we us said what we us are saying right now. Okay, wait. If you guys are really us, what number are we thinking of? 69, dudes! Look, we gotta go. Yeah, we gotta get back to the report. Rufus! Listen to this dude, Rufus. He knows what he's talking about. Right. Oh, and Ted, give my love to the princesses. Who? You'll see.
And you're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. The RTE TV series Obituary was a huge hit when it was shown back in 2023 and seen as one of the most original Irish dramas of recent years. It's set in the fictional Irish town of Kilraven and filmed around Bundoran and Ballyshannon in Donegal. It follows Elvira, a journalist with a local paper, who is paid per obituary she writes. And in order to boost her salary, she starts bumping off the locals. The series was picked up by international platforms such as Hulu and Netflix, and now it's back on RTE for a second series with new characters and a new director. Obituary's creator and writer Ray Lawler joins me on the line, and the show's director Rachel Carey is here in studio. Ray and Rachel, welcome both of you to Arena.
Thank you very
much.
Ray, I'm going to start with you. For people who might not have seen it yet, tell me a little bit about the origins of the series. Where did it come from?
I suppose it came from me trying to figure out how to write a TV show. whereas at the time, this is years ago, I was trying to write movies, and I said, things are changing here, so I'm going to write a TV show. And I basically said, I need a good setting for it, you know? So I said, what about a small Irish newsroom? And then I kind of thought, well, what kind of journalist would it be? And I said, I haven't seen an obituarist on a TV show before. So then I just had to decide what type of obituary it was, and I decided she'd be a murderer. So
that's a big enough stretch to begin with. It really is.
Yeah, it is. It is. I was looking for something very hooky that you could pitch to someone in a minute and they could picture it, you know. But I certainly wasn't going to write a nice, kind obituary helping out old people. I wanted a bit of fun and blood.
In terms of it, I've seen you talk about this before, about the initial creation of the show. This was something that didn't involve you going to RTE initially first to begin with, but Hulu were involved from day one on this, and that was kind of important.
Yeah. I think we kind of made the show the other way around, if you know what I mean, in that we went abroad looking for money first, so we came up with the concept, the script, and then as a team we pitched during COVID so we could do it through Zoom. So we pitched to American streamers, and then we got Hulu interested in. Luckily, the person we pitched to had written obituaries in college, so he got the concept pretty well. So then we started looking for Irish money, and we ended up with RTE, which we're very grateful for.
The new series is Series 2. It starts off at the very beginning with the new editor, Vivienne, showing up. She's played by the great Mairead Tyers. She's just fantastic. What was that character like to write? Because it seems like that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I knew I needed a big Scud missile going into the show to kind of, you know, recalibrate it a bit. And when you have a new character, sometimes you kind of go, look, I can do anything with this person. So I decided that this is someone who's going to allow me as a writer to give big monologues, say crazy, crazy stuff. And it really freed me up, you know what I mean? So it kind of designed this character that she can say and do anything. And then once you can kind of set her up, it's so much fun to write because you just rubs up against all these, I suppose you'd call them normies, and the reactions of the actors across from her are just so good.
Okay, this is Vivienne, played by Mairead Tyers, and she is the new editor at the paper, setting out her vision.
Name's Vivienne Birch, never Viv. Among many others, Alma Birch, my mother, owns this newspaper, which means soon, bone cancer, I'll own this newspaper. Oh, question for me, hon? Yeah, tough titty, because I don't do questions and answers. Okay, here's everything you need to know about me. I believe in one thing, competition. When I was four, my sister and I saw an ad for a doll. We told our mother. The next day, she drove us to the shop and she made it clear that she would only buy one doll. We had to decide which one of us would get the toy. I knew there was only one way to resolve this. We devised challenges, from sack races to egg and spoon. The battles raged. And then, the deciding contest. A staring competition. Our eyes locked on each other. Time stood still. Tears formed in our eyes as the seconds stretched into an eternity. Until finally, it happened. A blink.
Who got the doll?
No one, sweetie. I didn't have a sister. It was an imaginary friend type thing, and believe me, it was a shitty way to find out. Okay, from now on, each of you is in a staring contest with me. Under Huey, the paper was reduced to a laughingstock. We should be all killer, no filler. Yet, sales are soft, content is crap, and people will have to go.
Rachel Carey, you're the director, and you come on board at the beginning now of series two. So coming into something that's already established and successful, how do you go about making that your own?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's I'd been a fan of the show. I'd watched and enjoyed the show, and I really admired, you know, I kind of watched it the first time, and I remember saying to Ray, I was like, I was just amazed you got that made, like, as an Irish show. So high concept, it really was challenging, pushing boundaries. And, you know, I thought John and Una, the season one directors, had done an amazing job of establishing really high production values and something that just looked really slick. So what I kind of definitely felt the pressure of, you know, you can't just go into season two. First of all, you need to keep what's great about it, but you also need to move along. It's a difficult second season. You know, you have to bring the audience back with not just the same, but better. So I think, you know, the starting point was the scripts. I remember when I read them initially, I was like, what? You know, they were just so wild. Ray had really pushed the envelope out, as you could probably hear with Vivian there. So I knew the material was sort of there. So kind of my approach was to look at it as an audience member first. And, you know, what did I really like about this? And so what would I like to see more of? And for me, it was first and foremost comedy, because that's my bones. That's what I absolutely love. And I thought the show could take more. And also just the pure weirdness of it was what I really enjoyed. You know, it was just unapologetically a little bit mental while also being totally believable. So really what I came into it, what I said the first time I met with everybody was like, just push it. Like, let's just push it. Like, let's make it weirder. Let's make it funnier. You know, let's make it pacier. Even right down to the camera work, like meeting with JJ Rolfe, who's the cinematographer who I've worked with a good bit. We were just sitting together and going, push it. Like, let's turn the camera upside down. Let's, you know, change it up and just lean into the oddness of the show. And I think it really worked, you know.
What's it like working with the cast on this? There is a fine, fine cast involved in this series.
Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. Like, it was just such a good atmosphere. I honestly enjoyed going to work every single day. Siobhan Cullen is, you know, it comes from the top down. Siobhan Cullen is the number one on it. She is an incredible actor. I think she's one of the best of the generation. You know, she's so funny, but just she's such a pro as well. Really gets it, really easy to work with, just elevates everything that she's in. And Elvira's a tricky character to play, you know. So Siobhan helped me in a way get my feet under the table and kind of bed into Elvira. She kind of, you know, because she knew the bones of that character so well, I was able to work really closely with her about where she needed to go. And then, you know, just admirate Iris to anything I say, like an egg on top of something, you know, she's just going to make it better. And I was a big fan of hers from Extraordinary. And so she is just, again, phenomenal. And you've seen her probably in the Walsh Sisters at the moment also being great, and just funny bones, which is my absolute favourite thing in the world. And she was able to just slip into the Vivian character in a way that I think some actors might have struggled with. And, you know, we had to talk long and hard about what the hell Vivian was, and, you know, how we would play that to best effect. And but I think she just absolutely nailed it. So yeah, just fun all round for me as a director.
We haven't really heard Siobhan Cullen yet, so let's do this. This is Elvira visiting an elderly woman in hospital in order to hear her story so that she can ultimately write her obituary.
You are not a nurse. Why are you here?
Do you want the truth? Because at your age, it's not really advised.
Oh, tell me.
All right. I write obituaries. 4 months ago, I was stabbed. While I was in the hospital, I met a nurse who does shift work here.
Huh. Bernadine.
We struck up a deal. I pay her and she points me in the direction of people checking out early. death. Since I've been coming, this place has been hit by strep, E. coli, and whatever it is you have. Yeah. That one. All this illness has been lucrative for us both. So lucrative and, well, distracting. That's kept me away from my real passion.
Which is?
As I said, telling the truth to someone your age, not advised.
Not going to make it to the morning, am I? Then I'm glad you're here. I've a lot to get off my chest.
Ray, even just from listening to that, the tone of Obituary, it walks a tightrope throughout the entire series between the humour and between things you have to treat quite seriously. Were there moments or there scenes or arcs in series two where you were sitting going, I'm not sure if I've gotten this one right, or maybe I've gotten this perfectly right?
All the time. But I mean, the thing is, you know, we start the series with Elvira losing her dad, and I had to respect that for the character. So, you know, there was times where you just had to pull back the humor when you're talking about that and dealing with it, and then let it kind of seep in, you know, from time to time, because just to lighten the mood. But I had to really respect kind of that relationship with her dad. But, you know, I love putting an older actor on screen and giving them as many bonkers little lines as possible, you know. So I think because they're so up for it, you know, these actors and everything like that. So I think they're just looking for something a little bit crazy. But yeah, we have plenty of serious moments later on, but we'll never let them get too serious.
Given that the series is now an international one and you can now find it on platforms everywhere, not just an Irish one, does that international audience change the way you approach the writing of the series?
At a very kind of basic level, there are certain things, you know, I'm not going to be writing about Simon Harris and stuff like that, or, you know, so there's certain things. But at the same time, you're always looking to kind of be very true to like an Irish funeral or how we treat death, and you're hoping that the international audience will kind of get it and get a kick out of it and say, oh, that's how they do it over there. But you know, there's a lot of voices, a lot of different voices giving notes, and you have to listen to that. But I'm always kind of, no matter what, this is an Irish show, and I want it to be about real Irish characters, my real small little town that I've invented, you know. That's number one to me.
Rachel, I wanted to mention the black comedy Deadly Cuts that you directed, which was set in a North Dublin hairdresser's and which was fantastic. The representation of certain communities seems restricted to crime dramas rather than portraying them in comedy. That was the first thing I thought when I saw it. Would you like that to change?
Oh yeah, God, definitely. I mean, you know, I think we're all somewhat ignoring an open goal, you know, in terms of not making more comedies about, you know, different communities. For sure, like Dublin, the Dublin voice is something that I have always wanted to champion because I think it's funny. I think there's more to it than poverty porn and, you know, people pushing prams and dealing drugs. You know, there's a bigger voice than that. And I also think we live in a world now where there's such a sophisticated TV audience, and there absolutely is an appetite to, you know, internationally look at different cultures and kind of get a slice of different worlds and voices that they haven't seen before. And I think, you know, and we are kind of stepping towards it, but I definitely think there's a lot more comedy to be had. And you know, proper laugh out loud comedy, I think we've sort of got a little bit afraid of or something, you know. And I think it can still be absolutely slick and well produced and make you feel something, but you know, I definitely, something that I am definitely steering my career back towards is to try and get more stuff like that made, for sure.
I want to take one more moment from the series. This is Vivian again. She's hearing a pitch from Emerson, who's played by Ronan Raftery, about what he wants to bring to the newspaper.
Okay, jawline, it's pitchy time.
You're just the tip type bullshit won't work on me. I read a straight, but I'm bi. And any dudes I do are Spanish. So if you think you're going to come in here and rearrange my guts, you can jog on. Me pausing is not an open invitation to blather. Now, little birdie told me you've been coasting along for the last few months until the next big job comes knocking.
Yeah, I'm going nowhere.
I hate to burst your bubble. That depends on me. Why shouldn't I fire you?
Have you read today's paper?
Do I look like a fucking geek?
Well, you should.
The last minute addition to the lineup of candidates running in the local election is Kilraven's Patsy Ruan, 52. When asked what pushed him to run, he answered it was a young journalist from your paper. He told me I'd both the time and temperament to serve the people of this town.
Been working on him for weeks.
To get him to run?
He's one of the 8 candidates who pay their deposits. I am going to ruin the other 7 and help him win.
Is that ethical? Okay, but seriously, what's in it for the paper?
Patsy will be the worst possible thing to happen to this town and the best thing to happen to this paper. Think about it. 5 years, filled with that fool's antics, all that juicy material. He'll be a godsend.
Yeah, okay. I love it. But what happens if you don't get him elected? Oh, I know. You'll lose your job.
Ray, just to finish with you, how ambitious are you for this, for Series 2?
The goal was definitely we're going to outdo ourselves. We're going to leave nothing on the table. You never know. You may never do this again. I think it's, with the team we've had, I think it's brilliant. And everyone's just firing on all cylinders. So, you know, we try to make the best show of the year. We mightn't have done that, but that's what we try to do.
And Rachel, for you, coming in at the beginning of a successful series like this, is there always a small element before you start that of, I better not mess this one up?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And especially with so many people who have been in it since season one, you know, you kind of taken over the ship a little bit and you want to be steering it in the right direction. And, you know, and I was really conscious of all that Ray had put into it and kind of doing his scripts as much justice as I could. So, but yeah, I think we all came out at the end pretty happy with the result.
It's been great to talk to both of you tonight on the programme. Thanks so much for joining me on Arena. Obituaries creator and writer Ray Lawler and Rachel Carey, the show's director. Thanks for joining us. Obituary is on RTE1 Tuesdays at 10:15 p.m. and you can catch up with the shows, of course, on the RTE player. That is it from Arena for tonight. Produced by Reg Luby. Our research was by Liam Murphy. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator and sound supervision tonight by Tommy O'Sullivan. I'm Rick O'Shea. Talk to you tomorrow night again from 7 here on RTE Radio 1, and John Creedon is up after the news.